Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode of Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you would like to learn how to support this podcast, visit www.patreon.com/writingexcuses.
Hey, listeners. We want your input on season 20, which, I have to be honest, does not sound like a real number. What elements of the craft do you want us to talk about? What episode or core concept do you use or reference or recommend the most? Or what are you just having trouble with? After 20 seasons, we've talked about a lot of things. What element of writing do you wish we'd revisit for a deeper dive on the podcast? Email your ideas to podcast@writingexcuses.com. Season 19, Episode 19. This is Writing Excuses.
A close reading on world building, an overview, and why a memory called empire.
15 minutes long.
Because you're in a hurry.
And we're not that smart.
I'm Mary Robinette.
I'm Dong Wan.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Howard.
So to kick off this second series that we're doing of close readings, we are going to be talking for the next few episodes about world building, why it's important, how it functions. And to dig into that, we wanted to do a close reading of Arkady Martin's A Memory Called Empire. This is a really wonderful novel. It won the Hugo Award. And I am very biased because as a literary agent, I represent Arkady and I worked on this book, so I know it pretty well. But to kick us off here, before we dig into Memory Called Empire specifically, I wanted to talk a little bit about the concept of world building, what it is exactly, what are the basic mechanics, just so we all have a shared vocabulary heading into doing the actual close reading.
So when we talk about world building, it's really easy to get hung up and think that it is only about the things that you invent. But for me, it's also about not just the spaces, but the relationships between people and how all of the things interconnect.
Mm-hmm.
That it is world building because you are thinking about those connections, and the connections are often the things that are significantly more interesting than any individual thing that you invent.
Well, and it's worth pointing out, I think, that we tend to think of world building as being a part of spec fic exclusively, but regardless of what you're writing. World building is an important part of it. When I was writing the John Cleaver books, a big part of those books was figuring out how big is the town he lives in? What kind of people live there? What kind of industries do they work in? Where does he go to school? What is school like? What is his family like? Who are the other people that he's known? And that helps give the town a lot of texture and a lot of realism and a lot of plausibility. And that is absolutely a part of world building.
Yeah, what you don't show is as important as what you put on screen, because any novel or any short story, whatever it is, there's going to be way more details and facets of this world than you can fit into your book itself. So you don't have to invent every aspect, or if you're doing contemporary realist, you don't have to show every aspect. The way I think about world building, and this kind of ties into what Mary Robinette was saying, is it's about establishing stakes for your character. Because what parts of the world you show are the things that are important to the people in your world. So what the legal system is, what the physical infrastructure is, what rich people value, what poor people value, all those things are going to be part of your world building. And so as you're establishing what's important to your characters, think as much about rules and systems as you do about physical material spaces.
You use the word establishing, which always takes me to establishing shot. As you're doing your world building, as you're writing languages, creating religions, doing geography, whatever else, at some point, the rubber will meet the road and you have to write that first scene. And that first scene is your establishing shot, where you start giving people the details they need to understand what's happening here. If you look at a helicopter shot of New York City at the beginning of something, you know that this is taking place in New York City or a city. And if you have a helicopter shot zooming in over rolling fields of grain, you know that it is a completely different type of story. Mm-hmm. And just understanding that principle can help you set up that first scene so that your world building works.
And also along those lines, that establishing shot does not need to be a wide shot. That often zooming in on a single telling detail is going to tell you a lot about the world, more so than the rolling fields of green. So one of the mistakes that I will sometimes see people make with world building when they are doing it in spec fic is the feeling that they need to do that wide shot. Mm-hmm. And while there are times that you need to do it, and it's something that we'll see with Arkady's work, there are also places where just starting very, very tight in mm-hmm. is going to serve you better. And that decision is based less on world building and what you want to convey about it and more about the tone of the book. Like, are you doing something that's very intimate? Are you doing something that's really sprawling? When we start looking at Arkady's, it's a huge empire that we're being introduced to. So it is both a wide shot and I think a more detailed shot, which is a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. And part of why this is so fun to talk about in speculative fiction is that when you're doing contemporary realist, you have a lot of shorthand, right? You know, as Howard's mentioning, if you have a wide shot, a helicopter shot of New York City, you've established a lot of world that you don't need to explain to your audience. When you are inventing a new culture, so as we get into Memory Called Empire, when you're like approaching this massive planet city, there's so much you need to establish and explain. So sometimes in that case, when you do the big wide shot, as Mary Robin is talking about, it can be very overwhelming and not give you very much information. So zeroing in on a very specific thing often is a way to get to more information faster, because if you try to tell them everything at once, their brain's going to shut down. And that's when we start talking about quote-unquote info dumps.
Yeah, this is making me think of the beginning of Fellowship of the Ring, where there's a ton of world, the incredibly expansive world. He's famous for his world building. And yet the first several chapters and our introduction, our establishing shot, is all just the Shire. It's a peaceful little village with, you know, just a bunch of idyllic sheep and people eating happy meals together. Not actual happy meals, but they're eating meals and they're happy about it. And that doesn't tell us what the world is like, but it is vital world building because it tells us what the characters are leaving behind.
Yeah.
And it establishes, like you said, the stakes. This is what we're protecting when exactly. we leave here and go out into the rest of the very complex world.
A common mistake that I've made myself with regard to delivering your world building to the reader is delivering it the way the late 90s, early 2000s movie trailers did in a world. Mm-hmm. In a world guy, he's the guy who pitches the world building in 15 seconds so that you know the pitch for the novel. Mm-hmm. Okay. He is not the guy who opens your story. Having a story that opens with, you know, some text telling me where we are, and then the first scene contextually gives me 80% of that information. Yeah. You know what? We didn't need that text. Yep. I say we didn't. Maybe we did need the prologue to your novel. But consider if your prologue is in a world, mm-hmm. go ahead and just start with chapter one.
Well, and this is where I love the balance of show and tell, right? Because, you know, we hear the advice all the time, show, don't tell. But when you're communicating world building, there's so much information to get across that sometimes you do just want to come out and say the thing. You do just want to explain it. And, you know, I think a lot of our favorite examples are ones that don't do that because that is more memorable to find an effective way of showing it without explaining, but also sometimes slowing down and just explaining, hey, this is how this world works. This is how this legal system works. You will have to do that, especially in speculative fiction, because there's too much to explain to let your audience infer it. When I find myself getting super confused by world building when I'm looking at, you know, submissions, it is almost always because they have tried to adhere too closely to just showing me. And then I'm like, wait. I don't understand, because this could mean 8 different things.
Yeah.
So finding that balance point is the trick, especially early in your book.
I find that I break my world building kind of into 2 categories, decorative and structural.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So the structural things are the things that are driving the story. When we get into A Memory Called Empire, one of the things that's in there is something called a cloud hook. And Arcady just like drops us into it. It does not really explain it except in pieces, like gives it to us as the character interacts with it. And the reason that it's worth taking the time to have the character interact with it and spend that time with it is that later the cloud hook becomes this really important thing. But there's other pieces that happen in the story, like there are these little hummingbird-like things. We don't need to know where those come from or anything like that. Those are purely decorative. And that, for me, that I will see people put in a decorative thing that they're super excited about, and then people don't understand it and they try to explain it and it's not important.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I always try to do in my books is put in enough of these decorative elements that the reader is never sure until it matters which elements are load-bearing and mm-hmm. which elements are decorative.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things I love about the movie My Cousin Vinny, because it has such wonderful world building as you take these outsiders into this small southern town, and they encounter the mud, and they encounter grits, which they've never seen before, and all of these little aspects of small town life that just blow their minds, and then about half of them become vital to winning the case at the end. Grits doesn't sound like it would be a load-bearing element, and it absolutely is. And it's just...
if you make them thick enough.
Yeah, I was going to say...
So, yeah, it's the that ability to, I mean, it's not quite red herring, but it's just as you are explaining the world and where your story takes place, the reader has that thrill of not knowing which elements are vital to the plot and which elements are fun and which are both.
And this goes back to talking about how contemporary fiction can be a stretch in the imagination, because for, you know, 3 out of the 4 people here on this recording today grew up in grits eating country. So the idea that someone wouldn't know what they are, completely baffling to me when I watched this as a child. But on that note, let's take a break for a few minutes. And when we come back, we'll start digging into A Memory Called Empire.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I think a lot of people have heard the song Fast Car by Tracy Chapman, but if you haven't heard that song and aren't singing it to yourself right now, then really go ahead and listen to it because it's amazing. I will admit a little bit of theft here. My father has taught high school English for many years and always used Fast Car as a way to teach his students' point of view. And I think it's because it's a great story in the song that's all about this woman trying to get a man with the fast car to run away with her. But you get these little glimpses from her life as it is, as it will be, as it was. And it's a great way to look at how past, future, and present can all come together through one particular person's POV. So listen to Fast Car. And if you want to be like my dad's students Think about what it would be like if that song was sung from the point of view of the man with the fast car and not the woman looking for him.
Okay, so I would love to start talking about the text itself and why we chose this particular book. In some ways, it's a little obvious because it is right in the name. It is about empire. And when we think about big science fiction world building, we tend to think about space empires. We tend to think in fantasy about books like Lord of the Rings that have really rich, complex settings. I find the way that the author Arkady Martine approaches world building in this particular book to be really fascinating and nuanced and complex. But what about you guys? I mean, what did you feel about when this book was proposed, why we decided to settle on this one for the close reading?
I was so excited that we chose this book. I read it. I have right here with me my original ARC that I read before it came out. And it blew my mind. This is one of the best science fiction books I think I've ever read. And most of that stems from the incredible work that she's done with the culture. So much of science fiction is world building a new technology or world building a new alien or a new environment. And most of the work here is a culture. And the story is in large part about getting to know what this culture is like and how their names work and how poetry is vital to the things that they do. And it's just such a rich book because of that.
Yeah, talk about surprising load-bearing elements. It's rare that you get a science fiction novel that has load-bearing poetry recitals that radically alter the direction of the plot.
It's also unusual to get something with such an epic scope that has a single POV. Yes, there are other POVs for interludes and for chapter bumps, but the story is being told through the perspective of one character. And I think that's part of why the world building is so accessible and so effective. We have a stranger comes to town, really is the, well, not somebody goes on a trip is the story structure here. We are seeing a new place through the eyes of someone to whom this place is new, but she has loved it from afar and has studied it and is now immersed in it. And every paragraph gives us tidbits about this place.
So for me, the thing that is interesting and exciting is that it is not a single world, that every paragraph illuminates two worlds at the same time, because our main character, Mahit, comes from El-Sel, which is a space station. It is an unplaneted world and has come to this planet that is part of this empire, this massive empire. And so all of everything that she sees is seen through the lens of someone who grew up not on a planet and also has had this deep, deep love for this culture, but has never been a direct participant of it, interacting with people who are, you know, who have grown up in it. And so there's all of this really wonderful, like very muscular writing that is happening, where we're using all of the tools that are possibly at our disposal. She's using interactions with the environment. She's using point of view. She's using conversation. She's using every tool, epistolary things, every tool to convey all of this rich information, but had to create, like, there's two worlds that we are getting illuminations of, and then there's hints of other places and other cultures. And even within the world that we're in, there's multiple cultures for both. So that's why I was excited by it.
For me, one of the scenes that best calls that out is the cafe bomb. Because someone sets off a bomb.
We're going to dig into this very deeply in a couple episodes, actually.
But the idea that on a planet, someone can protest by blowing things up. But on a space station, that would kill everybody. It would never occur to anyone to protest by setting off an explosion, because that would destroy the world.
Well, and she has a whole speech, actually, where somebody did do that. And the consequences for that were so extreme, right? They immediately basically spaced everyone involved and cut them off from their Imago line. So they essentially just erased them from society in a radical way. And the difference in scale of response versus what you can do on a space station versus what can happen on a planet is one of those fascinating little things.
And so, yeah, so it calls up her perspective of, I come from this place, I'm now in this new place. If this thing happened in the old place, it'd be completely different.
It's such a novel of contrasts, and the way Arcady uses that parallax of perspective to give you perspective on the whole universe, right? Because 99.9% of the book takes place in one location, in one city, really between two offices primarily. Yeah. You know, it mostly just... The range of spaces in the book is very limited, but when you think about the book, when your memory of it is so expansive of a
sense... Your memory of Empire.
Your memory of Empire is a sense of multiple worlds, of massive systems, of huge space wars, but the action of the book is very constrained and very limited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say that, you know, on one hand, this idea of the outsider coming in is... It's just my cousin Vinny again, right? That's such a helpful trick and a wonderful little tool to explain one culture is explain it through the eyes of an outsider. But it is rare to see the opposite done. Like if my cousin Vinny told us as much about Brooklyn as it does about little southern town, then that would be closer to what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. The differences between them is... kind of the whole story.
Yeah.
And I love in particular how torn she is about this, Mahit. Mm-hmm. You know, you get this sense that she doesn't want to love Takes Kalanli culture as much as she does. Mm-hmm. That they are imperialist, that they are colonialist, that they are kind of absorbing and warping all of the other cultures, and that everyone who encounters them loses a little bit of themselves, but at the same time, she just really loves it. It's this kind of otaku visiting Japan sense almost, that she's like, I'm so excited I'm finally here. I've watched all of these movies about this.
Yeah. With the difference that Japan is not actively colonizing the United States. Yeah.
If it was a Chinese otaku visiting Japan in 1940.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is why this book is so significant to me personally. You know, the term we usually use for what you're talking about is audience surrogate, right? You have somebody who stands in for the audience arriving at the place and we see it through their eyes. So there's an excuse to explain all of the things about how this works, right? So this is Kitty Pryde arriving at Xavier's mansion. And then we get to see, oh, these are what all the X-Men are, right? But in this case, Arcady pulled an incredible trick, in my view, where the subjectivity of the audience surrogate becomes very important because they are not just a visitor. They are someone who is resisting assimilation, resisting empire by the place that they are visiting. What does it mean to love the empire that is destroying your culture?
Mm-hmm.
I'm Korean American. My family is from Korea, which was... This is a complicated statement I'm going to make, but has been occupied territory by the United States since the Korean War, right?
Mm-hmm.
The influence and dominance of American culture in Korean society cannot be overstated. And so the idea of coming from a colonized people, colonized by many people, you know, another example is the way Japan has colonized Korea. I love Japanese media. I watch anime. You know, some Japanese filmmakers are some of my favorite filmmakers of all time, right? Whether that's Kurosawa or, you know, a variety of other people, those things are very near and dear to my heart. So what it is to feel like you love the cultures that have actively or passively tried to destroy the culture of the people that you come from is a very complicated emotion. And to see that represented on the page by this person who is not only trying to figure out how to survive in the most literal way, but also to preserve her identity and her people's safety. It was such an inversion of the trick of the audience surrogate that I was completely blown away. And again, that contrast between the two perspectives gives you all of this depth and all of this complexity of the world she's encountering.
Well, the other thing that she also did, in addition to that, the other layer of it is that often the audience surrogate, you know, the fish out of water has no experience and everything is new. And Mahid is a subject matter expert.
Yes.
Fluent in the language, studied it, top marks, knows the history, and still, still there are these enormous lacuna in her understanding. And I think that those gaps, those places where herself, her home rubs up against, and her book understanding of a thing rubs up against the actual experience of it, those are the things that make the world building in this so meaty and that I'm so excited to be digging into over the next several episodes.
Yeah, I mean, I think many of us here have had the experience of living overseas or visiting overseas for a period of time. And it's amazing how much you can do all this research, you can speak the language, and still the texture of actually being there is wildly different, right? And again, this is a thing for me, you know, growing up as a child of immigrants, going back to Korea, is this culture I know so well in so many ways, but Korea is different from being Korean-American, right? Yeah. And so while that's not exactly Mahid's situation here, it was such a familiar experience of thinking you know how things are going to go, and then somebody says the word, and you're like, oh my God, what does that mean in this moment? I thought this meant this other thing, but now they're saying this. How do I navigate the social interaction that made sense to me through the filtered version I experienced or from watching movies, but then somebody's saying it to me right now, what do I do?
Yeah.
You know, and that is such a fascinating experience.
Yeah. And with that is this idea of loving a culture so much and living in that culture and still realizing that you're an outsider.
Yeah,
exactly.
And I had this experience living in Mexico. I lived in Mexico long enough to start to consider myself Mexican. I'm not. And I would never actually say that I am. But, you know, there is that bit of I don't really fit in here, but I do, but I don't. And this book explores that so well.
I think the power of this novel lies in the fact that as readers, we come away from it understanding what it means to be LaSalle, to be Texcalani. And we understand that there's depth way beyond that that we could never have because we weren't born there. We weren't raised there. And that level of immersion is one of the things that I love about good world building and well-presented world building. And Memory Called Empire pulls it off perfectly.
Well, I think that's a great note to leave it on. I'm so excited to dig in depth over the next few episodes about specific things about this book that communicate all the concepts we talked about here. So thank you guys for joining us on this little journey here. I have some homework for you in the meantime. And that is, I would like each of you to pick one of your favorite fictional worlds, whether that's Middle Earth or the galaxy in Star Wars or what Memory Called Empire, whatever world that has spoken to you in your past. And I want you to write down three defining attributes of that world. So think about ones that establish culture, think about ones that establish legal systems and power, and think about ones that establish physical spaces. All three of these things are going to communicate different things about what's important to your characters. And so if you make a list of those, I think that's a great starting point to understand how you can approach writing a world that feels robust and consistent.
This has been Writing Excuses. You're out of excuses. Now go write.
Do you like stars? I do. Maybe you'd like to put up a constellation of stars by rating us on Apple Podcasts. Hello. Yes, we're talking about ratings, not astronomy. But a 5-star review can help us by creating a navigational beacon for new writers like you to find their way to Writing Excuses. So, rate us on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. Let's talk about the rude tales of magic. In this improvised narrative role-playing podcast, join artists, writers, and comedians from Adult Swim, Cartoon Network, Comedy Central, Marvel Comics, and more as they fight and fumble their way across the madcap and exceedingly rude fantasy wasteland of Cordelia. Branson Reese and his jester's retinue, Christopher Hastings, Carly Monardo, Tim Platt, Joe Lepore, and Ali Fisher star as a group of unlikely survivors, specifically a talking crow, a lich in a wig, a bubbly fawn, a Sasquatch punk,
and a tiefling hunk. This group must solve the mystery of Polaris University's vanishment and return balance and higher education to their world. It's going to be very hard and very, very rude. Subscribe to Rude Tales of Magic on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. New episodes drop every Wednesday.
Writing Excuses has been brought to you by our listeners, patrons, and friends. For this episode, your hosts were Mary Robinette Kowal, Dong Wan Song, Dan Wells, and Howard Taylor. This episode was engineered by Marshall Carr Jr., mastered by Alex Jackson, and produced by Emma Reynolds. For more information, visit writingexcuses.com.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.